You are now tuned in to the Nancy Ruffin Show.
Welcome to another episode of the Nancy Ruffin Show. I am your host, Nancy Ruffin, and you are tuned in to your digital global classroom where we center on helping to develop the next generation of leaders. Joining me tonight is a very special guest, someone who I am excited to chat with. She is a powerhouse of a woman. She is a fellow Brooklynite. She is a Latina, and she is the first Afro-Latina running for mayor in New York City. And so just help me in welcoming the one and only Diane Morales. Hi, Diane. How are you?
I'm good, Nancy. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Listen, I really believe that this was an intentional, purposeful connection and conversation that had to take place. We have just too many connections between us. This was just bound to happen. But I really want to just get into this conversation because you are impressive. You have such an impressive background. And the fact that you are running for New York City mayor as the first Afro-Latina, I think that's historic. And so before we actually get into that conversation, I just want you to just give us a little bit, you know, about your background so that my audience really gets to know who Diane is as a woman, you know, and what has influenced so much of your life.
Sure. So I'm a first generation Brooklyn Boricua. Born and raised here. I'm the youngest of three, but really the youngest by like a generation because my sisters are like a decade older than me, my older sisters. And so, you know, I grew up in the hood and had a lot of, I was fortunate. I worked hard, but I was also very fortunate in terms of having access to elite institutions as I sort of grew up and went through the school system and became aware really early on of how transformative that could be. I also became aware of how poor I was as a result of that, right? Because you start going to school with wealthy students. And that just, you know, that made me recognize that I was getting access to things that other kids in my neighborhood were not, because there were fewer and fewer kids that looked like me in my classrooms and or came from backgrounds like mine. And, you know, I made a decision early on that I really wanted to do something to level the playing field, and spent a lot of my career early on trying to figure out what that looked like. Right. Ultimately, I landed, you know, in doing human services work, anti-poverty work, advocacy work. But along the way, I also became a single mom. And I am the proud single mom of two college students who are home now because of COVID. But, you know, living as a first generation woman of color and then becoming a single mom, and both of my children had learning differences, so we had to navigate the Department of Ed. I got a front row seat, right, to the challenges that so many community members face as they navigate the world trying to provide for their families and live in dignity, right? And then the flip side of that is I was doing this work. So that's kind of who I am and where I've come from. And I've been in the community forever.
You know, and I think that it's just so important when we start to think about who our politicians are, who we put in office, you know, to represent us. So often we see that, you know, historically, they might come from a family of politicians. We see that they are on, you know, they come from wealth and from money, and they use politics as a way to to maintain their power and their status. And so often when that is the case, the needs of the people that they're supposed to be serving kind of gets lost.
Right.
In all of that, because we tend to have politicians who become self-serving versus serving the actual community. And so I think for me, one of the things that really impressed me about you is that you are of the community that you're seeking to serve, you know, and I think that we're starting to see a lot of traction, you know, behind individuals kind of like yourself, AOC, who are just really tired of just politics as usual and really want to get into the race to make real change. And I think because you're not a career politician, that that gives you a bit of an edge. You know, how do you see that really benefiting you, you know, in this race? And also, how has it been a challenge, right? Because when you're really grassroots, now you're starting from nothing, no connections, no none of that. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm going to start with the challenges because I always like to end on a high note. I mean, and the challenges, I learn something new every day. One of the things I say to my team all the time is, I'm learning something new about the way this works every day. I don't always like what I'm learning because it's ugly. There's an ugly underbelly. But at the same time, I think it's so important for our communities to have access to that information in terms of how things work, right? So that we'll start, you know, I jumped into the race a year ago, a little bit over a year ago, because I knew I don't have the name recognition. I don't have the access to the dollars and the, you know, the wealthy networks. So it's going to, I knew it was going to take me a longer time. I needed a longer on-ramp. And sure enough, my candidacy was dismissed from day one. You know, where people would be talking about the mayoral race and list candidates and not only not include me, but actually say there's no Latinos in the race after Ruben Diaz dropped out. And so that's been a constant issue. The erasure from the media and from the chattering class, as I call them. Even with the people that talk about wanting change, they still measure your viability by using the old measures, by how much money you have, by how much, you know. And so it's kind of like what I said to people all the time is, we can't expect to change the system if we're still using the old rules of the system. So those things have been challenging, and the fundraising. But what I will say is that we are running, you know, I am not accountable to anyone but the community.
And right? You're not accepting funding from PACs or any
no corporate PACs
or anything, right?
No corporate PACs, no luxury developers, because I want to keep my integrity. I don't want anybody to think that I owe them anything except for the people.
Right.
You know? So, we have, that has actually taken on a life of its own. People are feeling it. People are hearing it. And in the July filing, we had more donors from New York City than anybody else in this race.
That's phenomenal.
And they were small dollar donors too.
Well, you know, small dollars can lead up to big dollars when it's in large amounts. And I think that sometimes people lose sight of that, you know, and I know that being a new candidate, being new, you know, in politics, it can be scary, right? Because you're going up against, you know, these people that might have more name recognition, they have more contacts, they have deeper pockets. And yet, I think that speaks just to the determination, the resilience of just not being a woman, because we have historically just had to fight and like claw our way, you know, just to get, you know, scraps. But I also think as a Latina, you have that extra fire, because that's just another layer that you have to, you know, kind of fight against.
Yeah. So I'll say this, and this is without any arrogance whatsoever. It's not scary to me to run against the people that are in this race. And I'll tell you why I say that. It's not scary because I feel like my actual experience, between my personal experiences and my professional experiences, I would put that up against anybody in this race. Because I also know how much harder we often have to work in order to get half as far. And so I am 100% confident that I have the skills and that my skills are competitive with anybody else in the race. Now, that's not how the narrative might be painted, right? In the media or in the public, but I know it deep inside, and that's the most important thing, right? And then, but then to your point about the resilience, I mean, I think there's a lot of truth to that, right? Because there are so many barriers that we have to navigate as women of color, as Latinas, right? In order to succeed. And I'm definitely at the point in my life where I'm just like, you know what? No one else is going to define for me what I can or cannot do. And if I think that it's the right thing to do, and it feels like I'm in the right place and I'm the right person, I'm going to try to do it. You know, like I'm just kind of over it, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like trying to play by the rules, trying to get the permission, trying to, you know, be validated. We just need to move past that, because it's those kinds of things are not going to be given to us.
Right.
We have to claim it.
Absolutely. And I think that is so key, because so often we spend a lot of our lives, you know, seeking the validation. And I think that when we get to the realization where we don't need no one's validation other than our own, that's really when we step into, you know, our full power, and we can really attack anything that comes along with less fear, right? Because when you're confident in who you are, when you know who you are, it doesn't matter what anyone else says about you, you know, or does against you. You stand in your truth.
That's right.
You know, and I think that's just from what I've read about you so far, just from seeing other, you know, reading other interviews that you have done, you really have, I think, the strength and the tenacity that New York City needs, you know, as far as the next mayor. Mm-hmm. I want to backtrack a little bit about, you know, talk a little bit about your experience, just because you haven't traditionally been in politics, you know, so for other people who may not be familiar with the work that you've done, can you speak a little bit about that and how that experience ties in with what you want to do as mayor?
Sure. So, you know, early in my career, I was an educator, or I am an educator. I was a classroom educator early in my career. And I taught in what was called a size 7 classroom, SIE, specialized instruction environment. It was, you know, special ed, kind of like the last designation before they recommended residential for kids. And that was an eye-opening experience, because I taught at the same school where I went to kindergarten. I didn't have a lot of training or whatever, but I was really enthusiastic. And my principal one day said to me, "I don't care what you do with those kids, keep them in the classroom, keep the door shut, and keep them quiet."
Wow.
That was probably a revolutionary moment in my life. Because at that point I decided that if the fate of our children's future was in the hands of people that didn't care, we were never going to get anywhere. And it needed to be people like us that could actually have a larger impact. So, you know, I've done a lot of things. I was part of a group of founding members of a national organization that just celebrated 26 years. We're in over 14 different states across the country. It's an organization that works to develop literacy skills in children, early childhood, right? That gave me the experience of building a team, building national infrastructure, of working at the time I worked with the Clinton administration to pass a legislation that would enable work study students in college to participate in AmeriCorps. So I have that kind of, you know, national level experience. On the local level, you know, citywide in New York City, I have run large scale organizations with tens of millions of dollars in budgets, hundreds of staff. I have designed programs that were so successful that the city replicated it citywide. I have designed workforce programs for young adults in the healthcare field that went on to exceed national averages in retention and promotion. Those are the things that I've done.
And that's really impressive, especially when we're thinking about just current state. You know, when we look at education in New York City, when we look at access, you know, to good education, there's so many challenges. And when I was preparing for this interview, you know, I had sought questions from my listeners because I really wanted to incorporate into this conversation, you know, the things that they're most concerned about.
Right.
And that you as mayor would be challenged with addressing. And education was like right on top of the list for those things. So one of the questions that was submitted by a small business owner from Washington Heights is what plans, you know, are in place or are you thinking of implementing, you know, should you become mayor to strengthen the school system, specifically those in lower income neighborhoods, you know, and you being an educator and having that firsthand experience, you know, what's lacking.
Yep.
What can be done to just to develop that?
Yep. Equitable funding is the first and most important thing. We don't get equitable funding in our schools, and that needs to be addressed. And that needs to be a budget priority. I think, you know, I also think about the line item that is now school safety officers, NYPD in our schools, right? You know, really creating an environment, a school environment where our children feel safe and taken care of. That doesn't look like having an armed police officer or a police officer at the school entrance. That's the first thing. The other thing is, you know, so before COVID, I used to talk about, we need to change what we teach and how we teach it, right? And that's very basic for me. We need a whole new curriculum that's focused on what I talk about as financial literacy, digital and technological literacy, and civic and democratic literacy. And anything that we teach right now, we could teach under the umbrella of one of those three topics: science, math, reading. It all fits under those things, right? But if we do it within that context, we're actually going to be preparing our kids to be able to be functional adults and citizens in this country.
Absolutely. You know, I think specifically with what is taught, you know, in schools, there was a time where, you know, they taught trades, you know, in the school. And I think that this assumption that every child is going to, you know, to be a scholar in the sense of, you know, maybe an engineer or a mm-hmm. professional like a doctor. Mm-hmm. It's not always the case. There's so many creative children, you know, who need to get into the arts or maybe develop a trade, but they don't have access to any of that in the current curriculum,
you
know, of schools. And I think that that is something that also has to, you know, be incorporated. We have to be able to provide these children with options, because for the child who's not engaged in math or in science, then what happens to that child?
That's right. That's right. And so I've also called for the creation of a K through 16 system. I think the DOE and the CUNY system should be seamless. And our young people should be able to go right into CUNY and do exactly what you're talking about. They should be able to pursue and explore all of the trades and get the training that they need and get the certifications that they need and get the experiential learning that they need to actually train for, be prepared for, and enter those fields. And that's the best way to do it, is to make CUNY accessible to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, when you provide that accessibility, you know, specifically when we think about trades, when we think about maybe mechanics or, you know, or plumbers or things like that, when they have a trade or skill, that equips them with the ability to be in business for themselves.
Right.
They can be entrepreneurs, right? And so when we're talking about developing an economy, you know, where people can really earn money, that has to start, you know, at the elementary school, junior high, high school level. You start teaching them what their options are, rather than trying to pigeonhole them, you know, into a certain field.
Right. That's right. What you're talking about is exactly what middle class families do for their kids. Middle class families don't say to their little one, "Oh, you're going to grow up to be a hairdresser." they open up the world to their children and say, these are all the options, and this is what you have to do to get there, right? So children from a very little young age in middle-class families understand the world, understand the paths to different options, and understand what they need to do to pursue that. And our kids don't deserve any less.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and I'm a product of the New York City public school system. And when I went to high school, my high school was considered a pretty, you know, good school. You graduated from Stuyvesant, which is an excellent one of those specialized schools. Mm-hmm. I went to Murray Bertram, which is walking distance from Stuyvesant. And back then it was a pretty good school,
yep. You
know, and I got a pretty good education. And I don't know, you know, if today that is true, just based off of what I've read and
right. What
I hear. And our children really deserve a fair chance, you know, at succeeding. And I'm a product of the CUNY system as well. You know, I'm proud. I went to Baruch. And then I went to the University of Phoenix for my master's degree, but I always had a very clear path of what I wanted to do because I had the foundation and I also had the support from my family.
Right.
And so I want to shift a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about the economy, especially now because of COVID, because it has wreaked so much havoc just on the middle class, on small businesses, essential workers. You know, I guess I want to talk a little bit about what your plan is. You know, if you step into this role, who knows where we're going to be with COVID, you know, next year, middle of, you know, the year. What are you going to do to help New York City, you know, kind of get back on its feet, support these small business owners that have had, you know, in some instances, shut down their businesses? You know, how do you help them to support their families?
Yep. So I'll tell you this, I'm going to center, elevate, and prioritize the community in every single way. And let's talk about what that looks like with the economy, right? Right now, as people talk about the economy and speculate about the economy, there's a lot of emphasis on big corporations and big businesses as our savior, as the ones that we need those businesses in order for the economy to thrive, right? But here's the reality. 50% of the New York City workforce is actually employed by small and mid-sized businesses. 50%. Wow. So there is no reason why we couldn't say, instead of saying, oh, we're going to prioritize the big corporations and we're going to give them tax incentives to come here and we're going to give them blah, blah, blah. We should be doing that with the small business community. We should be doing that locally. Right. And so everything that I talk about when I talk about the economy moving forward is based on the principles of a democratic solidarity economy. That's what I talk about. And what that means to me is that we invest and prioritize first locally. So whatever tax incentives we might be willing to give to a large corporation, instead of doing that, we invest those dollars in the people whose livelihoods depend on it, right? The people who are here and running small businesses. Because if we get 50% of our workforce back to work, guess what's going to happen? We're going to start stimulating the economy. Because if they're working, they're going to buy more. And that just becomes a positive self-fulfilling cycle. But in this model, we have prioritized the people here, not the profits of the corporations.
Right.
So that would be the very first thing that I would focus on. The second thing I'll say in answer to that question, because it's very complicated, right?
It is.
Is that the New York City budget, even if we're going through challenges, and I admit, you know, it's going to be hard and all of that, New York City is still the richest city in this country, right? Mm-hmm. And so we need to take a really hard look at the dollars that we do have access to and that we can control and how we're spending those dollars.
Yeah, I think that there has to be a really close look at spending, right? And where those dollars are going. You know, I know that there was a lot of, well, not a lot, but there was some money specifically given to, you know, for mental health treatment, right?
A lot
and,
of money.
You and were- yet I find that there is, it appears to be, there's so much of more of a bigger problem with mental health now in New York City than there ever has been, you know, and when we don't treat the community, you know, and those people that need that help, it trickles down to everybody else because then it affects safety. We see crime, you know, go up. And so I think that being able to really look at where money is going for certain programs is key. Because I know one of the initiatives that you support, and I want to talk a little bit about this, because I think that depending on the word that you use, people get a different meaning, you know, of it. So I want to talk about the police department.
Yep.
When we hear defund the police, right? Or when we hear divest from the police, it really has, it's psychological. Right. When you use one word versus the other, it gives a different perception.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little about what that means, what it really means, and what your position is on that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I've never taken the easy I've never taken the easy path in anything in my life. So why would I do it now?
Right.
So I was the first mayoral candidate to call for defunding the police. And I say that in the way that I think the movement means, defund the police. And what the movement means by that is that we have to make significant reductions to the budget that is allocated for policing, because the model of policing as it exists right now is not working and it is not keeping our communities safe. So what I did in calling for defunding the police was to couple that with calling for the creation of a community first responders department, right? The reality of it is that over 80% of the calls that the police respond to are actually not crimes. Mm. They are the mental health issues that you were talking about. They're homelessness issues, they're substance abuse issues. They could be traffic issues, right? None of these things are in and of themselves a crime. And so if we have people, if we have a department that is staffed with professionals who are skilled and trained to respond to the issues at hand, not only in that instance, are we actually saving people's lives? Because who wants to send a man with a gun to deal with a mental health patient? That's, you know, we're saving people's lives. And also we have the opportunity to connect those people with the services and programs that they need to actually improve their own lives. So what I mean when I talk about defund the police is there's no reason for us to have a military grade department that is literally training armies in other countries.
Hmm. So it's interesting, just because I understand what you're saying. And when we're talking about mental health, absolutely, I think that there should be professionals there to deal with these issues. However, when we're thinking about just those same individuals, sometimes you don't know what you're coming up upon. I mean, mental health patients can at times be violent, mm-hmm. Can be with a weapon. And so if we have this separate, you know, organization or department that you're speaking of, I think that we have to also be mindful of their safety and what we're sending them into.
Yes.
Because I think in theory, the plan, it makes sense. But the reality is that they're not always going to be able to talk them down. And I say this just from a very personal position, because I had a cousin who struggled with schizophrenia and he was a violent schizophrenic.
Yep.
You know, and he attacked, you know, someone in my grandmother's building, you know, with a knife. And so I think that we have to be that some of these solutions are great in theory, but we have to just be also mindful of what we're asking these professionals to step into, right? Because it's different when they're providing these services in a hospital or in an office where they know who their patients are versus as going on a scene and they don't know what they're going to expect.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And also what I'll say to that is the difference is we're talking about professionals who are trained and skilled in this, right? So, you know, I think there's a difference, and I understand what you're saying, right? Because I also have family members who have struggles. And it's different when you're dealing with a family member versus having somebody whose training and skill set is specifically in de-escalating those types of situations. That being said, it's not always going to be effective, right? That doesn't mean that there can't be backup.
Right, yes. Right?
So that doesn't mean that they can't then call in and say, we need some assistance,
right?
Because we're not able to, you know, to de-escalate this situation. But the assistant in that instance should not be somebody who's swinging a gun around.
Absolutely. No, yeah, 100%, right? And I think that that also ties in now to another part of the issue with our police department, right? And it's the way that they are trained.
Yeah.
And how, and maybe so, it's the lack of training that they receive. I think that something has to be done, not only with maybe shifting the resources to other programs, but how would you revamp the police department, right? Because it's not just about taking away the money, because you can take away the money and you can reduce the force, but then if you still have the same, you know, police officers with the same thinking and the same culture, we're not really making any headway there.
Right.
And specifically with the NYPD, we know that there isn't the best relationship with the NYPD and the current mayor. I think there's a level of trust that has been broken there. You stepping into this role now, right? How do you, one, regain that trust where you have a police department that is doing the job that they're supposed to be doing, but also respects, you know, the person that they're in essence reporting to, right? They work for the mayor, for the city.
Right.
So how would you tackle that?
Right. Well, the reality of it is right now they're not doing either. They're not doing the job they're supposed to be doing and they're not respecting the mayor. So it's like starting from ground zero. Right.
Yeah.
You know, the first thing I would say is I think leadership matters. I'm a big believer in leadership. And the police department right now is acting exactly the way its leadership is allowing it to act.
Yes. Right?
So that's critical. That's a key like beginning ingredient. And the second thing is accountability, real accountability, meaningful accountability. Officers being susceptible to real discipline, to losing pensions, to real consequences to their behavior and their actions. Taking a human life is not to be taken lightly and does not warrant a slap on the wrist. So, those two things for me are critical. And whether it's the vis-a-vis this, I've talked about the CCRB. I've also talked about creating an independent investigation and prosecution arm that would be dedicated solely to the police department and not do anything else, but also not be embedded within the police department, because that's a contradiction as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So I think that they're all great ideas. I have a question from one of your constituents, and this is from James P. from the Bronx. He wants to know, how will you balance the defunding of the police with the current rise of crime?
Mm-hmm.
And then what policies would be put in place for, again, the better training and then greater sensitivity?
Yep. So the balance, I think, between the defunding of the police and the rise in crime is providing communities with the programs and services that they need.
Mm-hmm.
The rise in crime has coincided with several things. It's coincided with a worldwide pandemic.
Yeah.
It has coincided with economic insecurity where people don't know where their next, you know, dime is coming from. It has coincided with housing insecurity where people don't know if they're going to be able to stay in their homes. it has coincided with the largest percentage of food insecurity increase in over the last 10 years. People are feeling a sense of desperation and helplessness that is unleashing all kinds of anxiety and uncharacteristic behavior. So I will say that, right? So, you know, with the defunding, it's not just taking money away from the police, it's really infusing those dollars into the community to provide services so that we can relieve these pressures and tensions and anxieties that people are feeling.
Yeah, because when you think about crime, right, why do people commit crime? Because they're lacking something.
That's right.
There's something that they don't have. And so they're committing these crimes in an effort to get that.
Absolutely.
And so you think about it, it's so easy, right? We know what the problem is. We know what the solution is. And yet we struggle, to do this in a way that is beneficial for the most vulnerable population. Is why I think that because of just your background, you have such personal experience with all of these things, just right. because of where you come from, where you've worked, what you've been exposed to. And I don't think that often we see our candidates have such firsthand experience in that, right? Yeah. And so one more question, and then we're going to shift away from the police department. But this was submitted by Stephanie from the Bronx, and she wants to know, how will you support individuals coming home from incarceration to reduce recidivism, and how do you support the families?
Yep. So I did a lot of work on this topic over the last 10 years in the Bronx, as a matter of fact. I ran a program for young people who were coming out of the system, who were court involved. And I ran an intervention program for young people who were starting to become, starting to have interactions with the criminal legal system. So if I take it on the back end, I think people coming out of incarceration need all kinds of support. They need support with job training and job placements. They need support with reintegration. What is it like socially, emotionally, and from a mental health perspective to come out? Because we know that the carceral system does so much more harm than good for our, members of our community. And so making sure that we provide the services and supports to help people be able to really sort of provide for themselves and live in some level of dignity is critical. Because the worst thing to feel is like, you've been thrown away and nobody cares. That includes access to jobs, right? The whole idea of connecting people and maybe even incentivizing employers for the training and the hiring of people who are homecoming, and supporting families in that process as well, because I know that there's a lot of trauma on both ends that's related to anybody in a family being sent to prison.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we see we see an increase in the prison system and the jails that are being built and the fact that they're a for-profit business. And so the only way for them to stay in business and gain that profit is if we continually keep sending people, to
right.
jail.
That's right.
And it starts, really young, with our kids.
Yep, the school to prison pipeline.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that was a great question that she submitted. And I think that's another opportunity for the next mayor, to really do something great there, because I think that's an issue that hasn't really been at the forefront for any candidate, right. And it's important because it does tap into, as you mentioned, that school to prison system.
Yeah. And make no mistake, this is also, it's a critical prong in the defund the police movement.
Yeah.
Because that idea, that movement recognizes that the issues start in our schools.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, it all ties in together, like all of it, right? The education, the policing, the economy, I mean, everything ties in.
Absolutely.
It's not going to make your job easy. and I don't want to keep you much longer. I have one more question.
Okay.
And this is specific about gentrification, right? And so we have seen that happen in a lot of our communities. You're in Bedford-Stuyvesant. So you see how Brooklyn, how much Brooklyn has changed. Williamsburg today is not the Williamsburg I grew up in back in the 80s. It's almost unrecognizable. And so while I think that developing a community is great, right? I don't think that it's great when it's at the expense of the people who have historically been there. So with that thinking, how can you help those in the community who are being displaced because of gentrification?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've as part of my, both my house, so you know, it's interesting. There's a quote by Audre Lorde that has come up for me a lot the last couple of days, and I'm gonna butcher it a little bit, but it's something like, there's no single issue struggles because there are no single issue people. And the reason why that strikes me is because I find that I can't talk about, you know, housing or gentrification or displacement without talking about the economy or talking about how, you know, like all of these things to me are so inextricably linked. And so for me, this issue cuts across the housing issue and the what I talk about as the democratic solidarity economy. And, you know, by that I mean, I'm a big proponent, not only of housing for all, but also of things like social housing, cooperative housing, things that increase the home ownership potential of local community members and prioritize the home ownership potential of local community members so that they are the ones that are building and self-determining what is happening in their community. Community land trusts that are managed cooperatively by the community members and institutions from their community. Those kinds of efforts to me, you know, and I'm tying it back also to what I said earlier about the investments in local businesses, right? Prioritizing those kinds of efforts anchor the people that are there and make it possible for them to stay and thrive.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So I want to thank you for your time, but before you go, I want you to tell my listeners, my viewers, you're a grassroots politician.
Yes.
You need all the funding, all the money
I do
you can get, right? So how can they support Diane Morales for mayor?
Great. Thank you for asking me that and giving me the opportunity. So, you know, we have gotten a lot of support across the city from people that, you know, feel like their voices have not been heard, that feel like they don't have a seat at the table. But we're working really hard to qualify for the New York City Public Matching Funds program. That's the thing that's going to allow us to really run a competitive race against the sort of corporate politicians and the establishment politicians. What that does is it will match every New York City resident that donates. It will match their donation 8-1. So if somebody donates $10, it will give me an extra $80 from the city to run a race, to run the race. And the matchable amounts are between $10 and $250. So the best thing that anybody can do if they have heard anything that makes them feel like I should be in this race, it would be to go to our website at diane.nyc, hit that donate button and make a contribution of at least $10. Anything under 10 will not get matched, but make a contribution of at least $10 to help me stay in this race. And more importantly, to elevate the voices of New Yorkers, because that's what I am trying to do. And if this is something that's important to any of the listeners, this is how you can elevate your voice as well. On social media, I can be found at Diane, D-I-A-N-N-E, the number 4-N-Y-C. That's my handle across Twitter, Facebook, TikTok. I was the first mayoral candidate to be on TikTok.
All right, make sure we connect with Diane.
Yeah.
And I will link all your information in our episode notes just so that it'll make it easier for everyone to find you and access all that you are providing You know, and again, for those of you, make sure donate $10. We can all afford $10.
Yes.
And if you have the time, you know, also volunteer, spread the word, get her name out there. You know, she is a New Yorker at its core, at her heart. I mean, and who better than to run the city than someone who is of the city?
Of right? us and for us.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Diane. I'm wishing you so much luck in this race. I can't vote in New York City, but if I were able to, you would have my vote.
Thank you so much, Nancy. I appreciate being here with you.
Okay. So until next time, mi gente, stay focused, go out there and crush those goals.
Thank you for listening to the Nancy Ruffin Show.